From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 724, Snarking About the Cloud with guest Corey Quinn. Recorded Monday, August 10th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts, LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today, coming back, I think for the second or third time, is a troublemaker, one of my favorite troublemakers in the whole world, Corey Quinn, who is a cloud economist at the Duckbill Group.
I got promoted now. I'm a chief cloud economist.
Oh, my goodness.
It turns out when you have multiple clouds economists, you need to start differentiating amongst them somehow.
Do you have multiple cloud economists now?
We do. In fact, I was the first of, at the time of this recording, three.
Oh, wow. So, I've always thought what you were doing was incredibly important, Corey. I mean, the whole screaming in the cloud thing at the beginning, especially, was this, listen, what they say it's going to cost you for cloud, it's just not true. And I do think you had an impact on the industry doing that. But
well, I'd like to hope so.
Yeah.
The honest answer is the reason that you thought what I was doing was so important is it turns out in hindsight, I'm an excellent marketer.
That's right. It doesn't matter how good the content is. If you tell the story well and engage folks on it, they're going to play.
I'm the best in the world at this. Just ask me.
You have elevated cloud snark to a very special level. In fact, you have done fundraising to benefit charities by snarking on Twitter.
Yes, exactly. That's called a very strange expression of deep-seated personality defects.
And yet, to the help of others, right? So at least you've learned to harness your personality defects to help people.
In seriousness, when I was a kid, this is going to shock absolutely no one listening to this, but it was challenging for me to find my place in the world because no one wants someone who's going to be a sarcastic jerk hanging out all the time. So how do you wind up getting there instead? The answer is well, if you align it with a good cause,
right,
or it's very clearly punching up, well, suddenly people are on board with that in a way that they never were before.
Right, right. You are then the Robin Hood type, right? You're speaking truth to power, so to speak, in a sarcastic way.
So they tell me.
Well, and again, I genuinely agree with you. And when we did the previous show, we were literally talking about this, you know, controlling costs in cloud and what you should be looking at and so forth. But times have changed. And I would like to point out, because you don't know this, but anybody listening on the day this published, this show publishes on September 11th. So I don't know if that's serendipitous or not.
You're way better at this than I am. Whenever I'm recording with someone and they say, oh, great, when is this going to publish? And the honest answer right now is, well, sometime between next week and February of next year.
Well, for me now, I've just set a date so I don't get to move it either because sometimes shows get shuffled around.
Right. That's the trick. Now, in seriousness, I'm getting ahead of myself intentionally on my show because I'm taking 2 months off for leave and starting in a
you
couple
got a
months
baby coming, friend? Recording.
I do indeed.
Well,
that's generally the reason one takes parental leave.
You would hope. I mean, who knows what, you're a strange character. I wouldn't know what to do with you.
Yeah. You know, having the first kid was, Dana's great and all. It's so easy and breezy and, oh, no work whatsoever. Then of course I'll sign up to do that again. I make poor decisions.
It is a chemical delusion, right? I remember my wife, when the second baby, in labor with the second baby, suddenly grabbed me by the shirt and says, now I remember why I didn't want to do this again. But at that point, it was much too late.
Oh, yes. It turns out that apparently terminating the pregnancy in the 18th trimester is frowned upon.
Yes. Yeah, retroactive abortion doesn't work that way. You know, you can't do that.
No, generally not.
Although I've certainly met some candidates over the years.
Yes. We try and keep it positive, though, for the most part.
Yeah.
But enough about people who are CEOs of large publicly traded cloud companies.
Nice. Okay, that's where you're going to go.
Of course.
Okay. And we'd be remiss not to talk a little bit about the pandemic. How has it affected your life? I got to think you're only busier than ever because everybody moved to the cloud all at once.
What I've done has changed.
Oh.
In that original beginning of this year, it was, I wish I could get away with traveling a little bit less. And then the finger on the monkey's paw curled inward and here we are. But it was more than that, because for the longest time, people were talking about fixing cloud bills in a very disingenuous way. Hmm. And again, they meant what they were saying, but what they actually needed was different than what they articulated. Specifically, our cloud bill is too high. That was not actually the problem for almost anyone. Mm-hmm. It was that it was incredibly variable and it was impossible for their finance group to build predictive models out of this. Yeah. And when customers came and said, oh, we're spending too much money on cloud because finance says we are, well, that's not how it works. It's that you wind up getting a $500,000 cloud bill for the month and it says Amazon on it and finance wonders how the hell many books you just bought. Well, it turns out that there's an understanding process you have to step your way through. And what they really cared about was that, yeah, sure, the bill's 20% higher this month over last month, but they would be saying the same things that were 20% lower. So it wasn't about saving money. Now in pandemic time, suddenly it kind of is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time since we've been in a conservative period where you actually want to be as efficient as possible and concern yourself with spending less. But I really appreciate the idea that consistency was important and has always been important, because finance people are inherently conservative. They want that consistency. But now it needs to be less. But I would argue that move to the cloud was actually about spending less on premises and being able to scale the pieces you need to scale, and folks needed to suddenly have a lot more VPN for work from home, like those kinds of problems.
Well, the grand secret too is that you're not going to save money on moving to the cloud on anything that looks like less than a 5-year timeline. It's not a cost game. It is a capability story.
Interesting.
And if you lose sight of that, well, I understand you got to say whatever story you got to say to achieve whatever outcome you're after.
Right.
But it doesn't work the way that you likely think you will in most cases. Yes, there are always going to be special unicorn corner cases, so please don't send me letters. I get enough of them as it is. But long story short, you're not going to achieve an outcome of saving money in anything that remotely resembles enough of a time frame for you to matter in terms of your career.
Right.
Average tenure of a CIO is what, 18 months?
Yeah, if you're thinking at that level, I'm thinking more at the IT guy level. The 5-year horizon to me makes total sense, in the sense of that's typically the lifespan of on-premise hardware anyway.
That sounds like quitter talk, says the person running 10-year-old equipment in the data center.
Well, as a responsible IT guy, I want hardware that's under warranty, and I want, I know how long those drives are reliable and so forth. And it's makes so much more sense to just roll over to new gear. But this is where that finance guy comes into play, right? And I think why the cloud's so compelling is you no longer have that huge CapEx bomb of, hey, I need a 2-comma number with a new gear and we got to re-sign with the colo, as opposed to a cloud.
But you kind of do in a way, because one, when you're doing the CapEx dance, you can play an awful lot of games as far as amortizing it out, playing these different games. In an OpEx model, it looks like a phone number going to one company every month.
Right.
And if you're at any kind of scale, sorry if I'm spoiling anyone's fantasy of the website's pricing being accurate, you're always getting an enterprise deal of some sort where you get a discount in return for committed levels of spend. This is broadly known as an open secret in the industry.
Yeah.
How do you negotiate that? How do you set what level of commit is the right one for your company? Too small, you're leaving money on the table. Too much, and you wind up having to cut a check for the difference.
Yeah.
Figuring out those numbers is part and parcel of what we do. And then, of course, helping companies negotiate effectively with their cloud providers. Yeah. There's a lot of different ways this manifests.
It's the reality that we just always, when we were on-prem and co-load and buying our own gear, doing the CapEx dance, we were just simply over-provisioning. And finance was happy with that because it was a one-time cost that got amortized consistently over a period. And so you didn't care the fact that you bought gear you were, at least 25 or 30% not using.
It's a spectrum, as I see it. In one of the spectrum, you end up building out in a perfectly on-prem environment. Great. You know what it's going to cost to build the data center. And once it's done at more money than you thought, once it's there, you can amortize that cost pretty exactly over the following 3 to 5 years.
Right.
On the other end of the spectrum, something that is fully serverless oriented in the cloud, you're going to spend way less money, but it is not at all clear what that is going to cost you until you start viewing it through a lens of a function of user traffic.
Right.
You only pay for what you use in that moment. Predicting that is going to be a challenge. Hell, reporting on it within the first 24 hours is almost impossible. There's a latency model.
Well, I would argue that even, the way you've been describing this is like at the end of the month, when you get that bill, factoring that into what is this in cost per transaction or cost per customer or cost per sale is hard too. It helps that you have a number, but how do you actually equate it to anything and say, where are our costs assigned?
It has to align with broader business metrics. And if you don't go through the effort of doing that and having these conversations in cahoots, or at least a single cahoot with your finance group, you're going to have problems articulating what this costs.
Yeah. And tell me they have the tools for this, right? Whatever cloud you're using, that it is not that hard to dissemble this stuff and provide finance with some coherency around this part of the cloud expense is assigned to that and so on.
Gonna disagree with you on that one. It's because there's so many different aspects of how things build. Shared services wind up killing you. If you've made an escalatingly poor series of terrible decisions and you're now deep in Kubernetes land, from the perspective of any cloud provider, you have one application called Kubernetes and it does some really weird stuff. If you're working multiple workloads inside of the same cluster, then how do you allocate the baseline fixed services? How do you wind up allocating the individual use of any given amount of resource at any given point in time? It's constantly changing.
So it sounds like I need to architect for finance too. Like I can create multiple Kubernetes clusters. And one of the reasons I would want to do that is so that it can be measured per app and at some more granular level.
Absolutely. But that's the question. Is it important for you to do that? If we go back to my serverless example, everything's pure serverless. At ServerlessConf, a cloud guru got up on stage and talked about how their entire compute infrastructure was done serverlessly and that it was costing them, big reveal, about $600 a month. How do you allocate and attribute that spend to different projects and different groups? The answer is no one gives a toss.
Yeah.
It's who cares? Your employees are embezzling more than that at office supplies every month. Stop playing that game. And when you start seeing a large serverless bill as a proportion of your cloud spend / total operating budget, then you start to have these games, as Simon Wardley likes to say, about tracing the flow of capital throughout an organization. Find me a company who's there or even close to there, and then we'll continue that conversation. I was incredibly bullish on the concept. It just isn't there yet.
Interesting. But I mean, yeah, everybody has that unicorn case, the $600 case, and real companies building out serverless, especially when they're at that experimental stage where they...
Well, to be clear, this is not a unicorn experiment thing they like to talk about on stage. That is actually what it costs to run their entire environment. Wow. Serverless is dirt cheap. I run a production system that generates my ridiculous newsletter on a serverless basis, and it costs less than $2 a month all in to do it.
Wow.
Now, I spend $130 to monitor it with Epsagon, and it's well worth it for me to do that.
Right.
But it's who cares money, how I allocate and attribute that spend. I could wind up saying that it's just the cloud bill and no one would blink an eye because it legitimately does not matter. Now, I have to instrument that and get much better visibility because of who I am. The cobbler's kids have no shoes and all, but that only goes so far. At some point, I need to be able to point at this and demonstrate that it's actually possible to do. But it is incredibly wasteful as far as people's time goes, viewed through a lens of actual direct business value, if this weren't the core competency of my business.
But we have this dichotomy then of I have out of control cloud bills, and then these numbers are too small to bother to measure.
On the serverless side, absolutely.
Right.
But if you take a look at most companies that are running meaningful spend in the cloud, there's a few things that you can generally assume.
Mm-hmm.
One is that their cloud spend is going to be dwarfed by what they pay the people who operate it.
Right.
And two, that the number one spend they're going to have in almost every case is going to be EC2 in an AWS context.
Right.
The virtual machines running the computer stuff. Add in, depending on who you are, but globally, you talk about RDS, S3 data transfer, and disks volumes. And those are the top five. That gets you, in most cases, to the around 80%, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
At a point where eventually you're now looking, sure, there's always going to be these corner cases where there's a lot of DynamoDB in this environment,
mm-hmm.
but it's not common. As much as we like to talk about the cloud and all the higher level services, people are mostly using it as a place to run their VMs.
Right.
VMware's future is assured. They are the technical, they are the payday lender of technical debt. Don't get me wrong.
Nice.
And there's nothing inherently wrong with that approach if it solves business needs.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not exactly plan A, B, C, or D.
But it sounds like the problem is that people are simply lifting and shifting their on-premises workloads into the cloud, and then are surprised that it costs money.
Well, that's also the danger of lift and shift. Someone pointed out recently an angle that I hadn't considered previously, where, okay, you lift, and then phase two is to shift it into something that's more cloud native. As your company continues to delay that shift phase, you wind up with a increasing amount of problems, because eventually one of the biggest challenges you have is the people who are very good at cloud in your organization will leave.
Right.
Because at some point they're running a data center on someone else's overpriced hardware. And to make no mistake, if you're viewing this through a lens of that's what cloud is, it is overpriced.
Mm-hmm.
You have to view it as a capability story and start leveraging to take advantage of it, or you will pay through the nose for something you could do cheaper online. Those, the cloud is just someone else's computer types, are not inherently wrong.
Just a bit obnoxious.
That's all it is to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Save some money, buy some nonsense, put it under your desk and call it a day.
Right. So you can do it that way. You just don't get the benefit from it. Why is it punitively expensive? Because it is actually expensive to the vendor? Is the vendor figured out this is our easy money?
It's expensive because if you're just viewing this through a lens of I need X gigs of RAM and Y a number of CPU cores and that's all I need. Well, there is an inflection point where you can get those things for less money at scale to put in a data center.
Right.
But you're still going to not have the same reliability the cloud provider is going to provide you. You're still going to have network challenges. And again, some of the best people in the world are focused on solving very strange stuff like hard drive replacement. You ever notice you don't have to think about hard drive replacement anymore at a time of cloud?
Yeah, no kidding.
Great. But and there's value to that.
Yeah.
But at a certain inflection point, I mean, Facebook has been famously on-prem for most of their existence, and I don't think anyone's suggesting that they should do otherwise at their point of scale.
Yeah.
If you're doing Twitter for pets, on the other hand, yeah, being able to click a button, get something up that doesn't require waiting 12 weeks for contracts to get signed is absolutely valuable.
Sure.
But there should be the idea of using elasticity. People talk about how the cloud is elastic. They mean that you can scale up to meet demand, which they do, and then scale down, which they absolutely do not. And it only makes sense if you're leveraging it in a way where that is realized. If you fail to scale up in time, yeah, you're dropping customers on the floor and that's bad.
Right.
Fail to scale down in time, and well, you're just spending a little extra money, and that is not the end of the world as far as companies are concerned.
Until finance shows up and goes, why is this build so huge?
Right. And then it becomes an open series of questions and dialogue.
Absolutely. And Corey, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. Users are in the office and out of the office, but your problems are still your problems. Windows is still Windows, your browsers are still your browsers, and your users are still your users. How are you going to simplify management of them in the brave new world of both on-premises and remote work? Relax. You've got Policy Pack. Policy Pack works with both always connected and always on the go machines to help you increase security and manageability on your multi-session Windows 10 instances. With Policy Pack, you'll be able to remove local admin rights, yet enable standard users to install software or overcome UAC prompts. Proactively block malware and unknownware. Configure and lock down browser and application settings. Dynamically configure file associations, start screen, and taskbar settings for every user. Use your existing root policy or Intune to deliver the settings once and have your users get exactly the settings they need in the office or on the go. Simplify modern desktop management no matter where your users are with Policy Pack. To learn more, head over to policypack.com/remote work. That's policypack.com/remote work. Policy Pack, securing your standards. Listeners to this podcast are eligible to win a free copy of the Cybex Wiley book entitled MDM, Fundamental Security in the Modern Desktop, Using Intune, Autopilot, and Azure to Manage, Deploy, and Secure Windows 10 by Jeremy Moskowitz, Enterprise Mobility MVP. Simply pick Run As Radio in the dropdown when you visit policypack.com/remote work. Good luck, and we hope you win. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's my friend Corey Quinn, who is a cloud economist and definitely sprinkling some great thoughts here around just the whole reason you migrate to cloud architectures is to use infrastructure more efficiently. The problem with allocating out VMs like this is they don't know what you're going to do with it. So they simply allocate it to you and bill you for it. Am I wrong?
Well, to be fair, some companies do drop the ball sometimes and sending the bill out in an efficient manner.
But I do get the idea that the problem with using VMs essentially is because you have complete control over it, they're allocating that resource to you, so it's going to cost a lot more, as opposed to these serverless model and cloud-specific resources like Dynamo and what's the Azure equivalent, Cosmos.
Cosmos DB, yes. And to be clear, I am not trying to make people who are running these things as VMs feel bad. Everyone is doing that to some degree.
Yes.
It's the nature of the world. I mean, I can sit here in my ivory tower and say what things could or should look like, mm-hmm. but that doesn't inherently mean that anyone who's doing this is wrong. It is a very common path. My concern is when people start telling lies about what they're doing, and the lies that annoy me the most, the ones they tell to themselves.
Right.
Sure, get on stage and tell me whatever you want. I understand. Baby needs a new pair of shoes and you've got stuff to sell. But go beyond that. Tell me a story of what it is you're doing, why you're doing it. Tell me about the constraints. Get on stage and tell me something honest. Yeah, we moved to the cloud for reasons X, Y, and Z. And yeah, 80% of our workload is still running as VMs on this. And mm-hmm. while that's not ideal, it's good for us. And here is why. There are honest stories about that. But instead, people like to hand wave it away and talk instead about this one test application that they're running somewhere that has the modern future.
The cloud architecture. Though.
Yes. Lies, damn lies, and vendor keynotes.
Nice. Nice, nice, nice. Now, are you still that Amazon-centric? Where does Azure and Google Cloud come into play these days?
Excellent question. I'm focused on AWS at the moment because the orders of magnitude of the bill are larger
right.
than the ones I'm seeing in other places. I'm not partisan, to be very clear with you.
Oh, no. I've seen you snark at absolutely everybody. There's no partisanship there at all.
I do. Absolutely. And unless you're picking IBM, there is no bad answer for which cloud provider you're going to go with. Now, I'll say something surprising to some folks. I think Oracle Cloud is dramatically underrated for what it is. It deserves a lot more credit than it gets. It deserves every ounce of the crap that it gets for the Oracle part of the name.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not defending Oracle's business practices. But from a technical-only perspective, spoiler, cloud vendor selection is never a purely technical decision.
Yeah.
They have absolutely built something that is phenomenally interesting to me, and I'd like to spend more time working with it. You know, once the lawyers finish reviewing.
Well, and therein lies, I just think they're super late to the game. You know, for me, coming from the Microsoft sort of perspective on things, Oracle always seemed to be the one that had all of the ingredients. They had a development platform in Java. They had the opportunity for some infrastructure. They had dev tools. Certainly the flipping database, which they focus way too much on. If they got into the cloud game, like they offer a full stack that almost nobody else offers.
They even have a very robust serverless offering that at one time started off as something, in my position, better than Lambda.
Wow. Yeah.
The iron.io folks, or the IP, I forget exactly the story, became Oracle Cloud Functions or whatever they're calling them. Who knows? But it's the fact that I don't even know the answer to that is part of the problem.
Well,
but
yeah.
The way that they've built it, the model and the way they envisioned it is phenomenal. To give you a very real example here, I have that ridiculous nonsense architecture diagram I put on Twitter from time to time of how I build the newsletter using a whole bunch of serverless services that AWS offers. Every single one of those, with the possible exception of Comprehend, which is an AI learning thing that applies tagging, but it has its equivalent in every provider, including Oracle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not a bunch of random server stuff. It's there are functions, there are API gateways, there's a DynamoDB equivalent. There's using DNS as a database because it's the best database. And all of these providers can hit all of those different pieces relatively easily.
So what makes someone choose the Oracle Cloud over the bigger players?
Existing relationships with Oracle historically, and
yeah.
that's been one of the problems. But mm-hmm. one thing I'm starting to see a glimmer of hope on is that they are 10x cheaper on data transfer outbound.
Right.
That's why we saw the Zoom and the 8x8 deals being done with Oracle. I think that those are, if Oracle doesn't screw this up, potential indicators of things to come because
yeah.
the data transfer pricing on the tier one providers is awful.
Yeah. And that is a direct punishment and questionable charge. That's not a lot of hardware. That's just networking. Like, why is it so expensive?
I would argue on that point because that was my original approach. And mm-hmm. I had several providers reach out with a, now you listen here type of approach to it.
Right.
Yeah. You ever notice how you can run these VMs in any provider you've got and get the full published line rate to all of those VMs at any given point in time? Yeah. Try that in your data center. You wind up congested at top of racks, which is, you can wind up having problems with it as you scale and have certain points talk to different other points and they hit constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck finding that in a cloud provider. There's a lot of magic that's happening as a result. It's incredibly robust and incredibly durable. The problem is that unlike every other resource you can name that a cloud provider sells you, there's no sliders that you can adjust on that where, well, I don't want to pay through the nose for the networking. Shitty networking is just fine with me. So I'm going to go ahead and scale that one down and save some money. There's no option to do that.
Right.
I would like to get this data from that region to that other region. Okay, when do you want that done? Well, next Tuesday sounds good.
Right.
And that's enough. But that's not the option you get.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a great point that there's really no granularity in networking at all. And the expectation is magic.
Yes. And it's not something they talk about. So everyone looks at this and feels egregious.
Yeah.
I think they've also made a terrible blunder in making data transfer inbound free.
Right.
Because that it is clearly not free and this stuff applies, but that is the business direction they've taken this in, which makes it feel like, oh, network transfer could be free if they wanted it to. They're just not doing that.
Yeah.
It is a massive mistake.
But it's part of we're trying to get people into our system, right? I get why inbound would be free. Am I wrong there? Is that why they're making inbound free?
I think there are a few reasons to do it. One, if you only meter one way, that makes it a little easier from the math perspective. Mm-hmm. But it also does not incentivize people to keep their data out of the cloud. Put it all in. It's free.
Right.
Yeah, I sort of see your point, but only a fool believes that there's no charge affiliated with that.
Oh, you want it back? Where are
you going to store it? Because that's going to charge you.
Yeah. Well, I could also think, is the inbound in terms of other people hitting your site? If you started charging for that, it's something you can't really control. Your response to that is something
you have to respond
control.
With something when people hit your site. So
yes.
It sort of is. Mm-hmm. The other story, too, is it leads to really weird architectural designs. For example, you have mobile apps that don't necessarily that you want to be able to make sure that the data lives in multiple regions, but you don't want to pay the transfer rates between them. So you teach the mobile app to just submit the data twice. And that winds up means that it's being subsidized by your customer's cell phone plans, which is not ideal. But at any individual basis for those things, it tends to be effectively no data. But in the aggregate, it saves you a boatload of money.
Yeah, no kidding. That's twisted. But I totally see how you would get there. And if the ROI makes sense, literally to double submit to hit cover two zones rather than to just send it once and sync between.
Yeah. And then multiple providers becomes a story. And then we're into the land of multi-cloud, which is just generally a terrible pattern.
Is it? I don't see the justification for multi-cloud. Everybody talks about it, but it doesn't seem real.
There are a few. One, if you're a particularly regulated industry in particular places, and there's a hard requirement, the UK specifically is famous for this.
Mm-hmm.
Two, if you have a strategic reason where you need to be in multiple cloud providers at different tiers, for example, if you're a publicly traded company and everything lives on AWS, that's great. You need to at least for your own BCM or business continuity management planning, be able to say, okay, we can rehydrate the business by backups that live in another provider. That makes a lot of sense. And even on a basis of this one workload is going to live somewhere else.
Right.
And depending on where you define cloud as starting and stopping, if you use AWS for its database and compute offerings, you're making great choices. If you're using them for their code commit instead of GitHub, for example, you're making terrible ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pick the best of breed for certain workloads. But for your infrastructure as a service stuff, you want to be able to have something aligned with what your company is doing. And having to teach your teams who are working on those same workloads to use all the different cloud providers is almost always a giant waste of everyone's time and energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just seems like people are moving, they're only doing half the job each time. They don't really embrace what the whole job you've got to do here.
Absolutely. That is a great way of framing it. It is so easy to wind up trapped in this place. Well, we believe that it's important for us to be in multiple cloud providers. Well, why is that?
Yeah.
Well, we're a startup and we want to be able to sell to the retail industry. Great. Okay. That potentially becomes a reason to pick a provider that is not Amazon.
Right.
But I would suggest pick whatever provider that is and go all in.
You know, this reminds me of the debate 20 something years ago on when you're trying to build a retail product, supporting multiple databases, right? Supporting SQL Server and DB2 and Oracle. And what it meant was that your database access was bad on all three rather than being good on one of them.
Yes, absolutely. You wind up distilling everything down to its lowest common denominator. And even load balancers don't react the same way.
No.
So you have to take into account these things. The networking is always a disaster fire.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about the companies that have spent a significant effort in those abstraction layers. They're not actually using it for anything. On my podcast a couple of years ago, I had Mitchell Hashimoto on, and he said, no, Terraform is not built for multi-cloud and workload portability. It's built for workflow portability. but you're going to have some changes between every provider.
Sure. That's just to be expected. Well, and is the lowest common denominator actually Kubernetes?
Oh, good Lord, I hope not. That is, it feels like Kubernetes is a make work project for people looking to bolster their resumes. Look, it does some amazing things and solves some amazing problems at Google scale. But for most of us, that ain't you, folks.
Yeah.
And finding and trying to shoehorn your use case into a Kubernetes future, good luck. I mean, it's obviously gained terrific adoption across the board. I just don't like it. And I think that it is overlooking a number of far simpler approaches in favor of arbitrary complexity, because, well, whataboutism is running rampant.
Yeah, sure. And so, and the simpler implementation being serverless.
Absolutely. Well, serverless is not necessarily the right answer either. Right. That feels like it's more of a forward-looking future approach to many greenfield things.
Mm-hmm.
Containerization feels like it is supplying a sort of a backwards compatibility story
right.
for existing legacy applications. And please don't think that that's in any way condescending. It's not. The world is built on legacy.
Yes.
Legacy means it makes money.
Yeah, that's what it really means. And it is interesting to think in terms of, does it make sense to put energy into containerizing an existing application versus leaving it in a VM and peeling pieces out that are having performance problems into serverless instances of some kind?
Exactly. And to be clear, serverless instances aren't really a thing. That tends to be
it's not actually an instance.
Nomenclature is incredibly important. In fact, arguing about names is the entire thing that powers this entire industry.
The joke is that under the hood, serverless is actually containers. You just don't own any of it and you're happier that way.
If we're looking at it more realistically than that, it's not exactly containers in the way that we think of or know containers. The criticisms of serverless are valid in some ways, but that one never tended to resonate with me. Like, but if you go with serverless and go with one provider, then you're putting your availability in that provider's hands.
Yeah.
Yes, but you were already. Let's be honest here.
Yeah. It's just, it used to be your provider was you and you suck.
Exactly. And that's the story. I saw a bunch of sysadmin types after the S3 apocalypse in 2017 saying, now we're going to go multi-cloud and multi-region to avoid that ever happening. Cool. You're going to double or triple your infrastructure spend in order to avoid a black swan event that could never recur even before it was fully recovered from. And you're going to do that and think that whatever abstraction level shim you built on top of this is going to have superior reliability to freaking Amazon's S3. Good luck.
Yeah, it's almost like we glory in the scars, right? Like these occasional battles that happen shape, you know, we almost are excited. It's like now I have a position that may be a little controversial, but it's, you know, won from, you know, hard fought battle of an outage on S3. In exchange, I'm going to torment my entire company for it.
Bingo.
Yeah,
and that's the trick, it is way too easy to wind up in these stories of, well, we have this imagined theoretical world where this is going to become a problem and we're going to need to plan for that eventuality. Never mind the fact that that reality is years away.
Sure.
Solve for the problems you have today.
Yeah.
And leave yourself a strategic exodus. I would probably be disinclined to build the entire system on top of a database model that does not have an equivalent somewhere else. Yeah, maybe that means you don't get to use DynamoDB for this stuff. Okay, go with MySQL. You'll get something like that anywhere. And even understand that MySQL is still not apples to apples between everything, but it gives you a better theoretical exodus.
But stuff like DynamoDB and Cosmos DB is really about those extreme cases where you can build out a, you know, multi-location, eventually consistent data store. But why would you when you can buy it for a set rate?
Right. To be clear, if I were looking at having to potentially do a database migration, I would be hard pressed to avoid MongoDB.
Sure.
And the reason behind that is that database migrations are super hard. And given MongoDB excels at losing your data, you're not going to have nearly as much of it to migrate when that happens.
And you're setting your expectations up front.
Exactly. But plan for data loss, nice. Also known as choose Mongo.
Yeah. But, you know, really you get into another aspect of this, which is most of the time your data is just not that relational. And the way you're analyzing it is not relationally anyway. So why are you contorting it into relational forms? Store your goo as goo.
Yeah, you could. I think the reason behind that is that if you have just goo, storing that in a relational model, people can imagine that for almost anything. There's very few types of data you can't shove into Google Sheets, for example, which
right.
is sort of the closest analogy we've got. Whereas if you need to start doing relational data work, on top of something else, you've got to contort yourself. So it makes for relational being a very reasonable default choice. Mm-hmm. I don't blame people for going down that path.
Yeah, but the cloud has really changed that, because what used to be, if you didn't organize this data, it took forever to try and organize it, and that cost you a lot of time. Today, you can simply rent the compute to organize it for you at the moment you need it.
Yes. Oh, the NoSQL story, too, is like, oh, you've just got to know what your data query patterns look like in advance. It turns out that you have to know what you're doing is a hell of a bar, because spoiler, none of us do.
We're all making it up.
Yeah. You just have to know what you're doing in advance. Right. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah, you're only going to know that.
Get right on that, Professor.
Yeah, after you've already done it and failed at it and then gotten over it. Now you know what you're doing, but you're never going to need to do it again.
Exactly.
Well, Corey, you know, I think we snarked about the cloud for a half an hour there.
Fantastic. Wow, time flies when you're having sarcastic fun.
So where can folks find you? Of course, I've always been a fan of streaming the cloud, but other places they should be looking?
Oh, yes. Last week in AWS.com is sort of the entry point. It links to my sarcastic Twitter feed. It points to the newsletter. It points to both the Screaming in the Cloud and AWS Morning Brief podcast. It has the blog on it. This is the problem when you start spreading yourself too thin. It's one of those, oh, where can people find you? Everywhere.
How can people avoid you?
Ah, that's a better question. Yeah, go work heavily in the IBM ecosystem. That'll do it.
That'll keep you safe. Well, Corey, thank you so much for coming back on the show. Always fun to chat with you, friend.
It really is. I'm a treasure and a delight.
Nice. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.